Well, listeners, it's been quite a while since I've done a podcast with coffee. It's a different restorative than what I'm used to recording a podcast. Anyway, welcome to the Halloween episode of Mars on Life. The big difference with this episode, though, wait for it, Andrew. No, I'm kidding. Trying to dramatic effect. I'm like Ricky Gervais right now. I'm so sorry, listeners. But what's cool about this episode is that not only is it not going to be a bonus episode like our Halloween episodes typically have been in the past, this is also episode 190, which means we have 10 episodes to go, because I still remember simple math. We have 10 episodes to go. Can't believe it.
Yeah, good times. I mean, time flies. I don't remember the episode number of the Bringing Out the Dead last year, but it seems like it was yesterday. So, and it's good to be here in person. You know, Lynch would be proud of us drinking coffee and talking about his movie, so I think it's a good time.
You gonna drink that coffee? God. So we're going to talk all about, as Andrew already alluded, we're going to talk about David Lynch's 2001 film, Mulholland Drive. This is definitely a movie I've talked about a fair number of times on Mars on Life, but it's always been kind of one of those orbital things. I've never just, you know, dived right into it. Getting to talk about this now, obviously listeners are probably wondering, well, it's not a horror movie. It's nothing like, you know, Bring Out the Dead or Exorcist 3 or, you know, I mean, Shin Godzilla is a creepy movie. It's arguably by no means a horror film, despite having very frightening horror elements. But with this movie in particular, if I had to sort of set the ground for why we're going with this movie, or at least why I thought this would be perfect for a Halloween episode, is not only the horror elements that are in it, not just the surrealism, but also, and this will in a lot of ways allude back to the episode Matt and I did, that was sort of the part two to the museum trek that he, myself, and Sebastian had last year, where we talked about the city of Los Angeles, we talked about the sunshine and noir duality that I know Mike Davis talks about in City of Quartz. And I feel like this movie delves into that, but with a little more flair towards Hollywood, obviously, given it's in a lot of ways a movie about movies and filmmaking. Before we even get into all the metaphysical stuff with the movie, I know you have a lot of thoughts, so I'm dying to hear what you thought. This was your first time viewing it, right?
Yeah, after, you know, I'd actually, and I, you know, we'll say the spoiler alert now, but, you know, I had seen one of the more infamous scenes of the movie on TV as a child and just being like, what is that? So, I still felt tense when it came up. It's pretty early in the movie, but, you know, I never thought of this movie as an LA movie, because this is something interesting, I guess, thinking about. It's called Mulholland Drive. How many Angelinos have driven on Mulholland Drive? You know, in my life, I had only been up in those Hollywood Hills, if that's what we're talking about, like once or twice. And I think because it was so surreal, this is not a movie that's going to be on ABC 7 on the weekend, you know? This is not, I hate to say it's not accessible, but like it kind of is. It's mysterious. Even Lynch's other work is more accessible. Like, I just realized today, Wild at Heart features the famous Chris Isaac song. So it's like, so it's just like his other movies have famous people. I don't know how famous Naomi Watts was at this time. Justin, you got a young Justin Theroux and a few other cameos, but it is a mindfuck. It is the ultimate Lynch movie when somebody says Lynch. You know, I'm sure there's another discussion to be had when we watch Lost Highway one day or some of his other pieces, but when people say David Lynch is weird, this is what they mean, and I say that with love, because it was a really good time, very thought-provoking, and yeah, an LA movie, but not how you'd expect. I think, you know, in the Criterion Collection menu, it shows a shot of LA with your classic Lynch ominous music, and you don't know what to expect, but it gets going, and if you're from LA, you recognize, oh yeah, that's an apartment building that I, you know, everybody's has an apartment building in their neighborhood like this in LA. Or the little LA-isms of just like the Winkies, the Denny's, even as we talked about before the pod, even walking to the back of a Denny's and how like kind of just it's just a little back alleyway and a trash can, and it's like you could tell Lynch lived in LA and knew what he was doing when he made this movie. There's some scenes in the movie where they go to downtown LA, and this is the year 2001, but you get the sense of how like I guess grimy like the late night crowd. So I think, you know, off the bat, it's a really good LA movie, even if it doesn't show the Watts Towers, even if it doesn't show the beach. I think it's a really honest depiction of LA and Hollywood that, you know, any man can or any resident of LA would recognize. So I think in that aspect, it was really nice to see that depiction.
The first time I ever saw it, it was on formerly HBO Max. And initially, I had no idea what I was getting myself into, other than it wasn't even the typical cover like on the sleeve of the Criterion box where, you know, it's kind of the ethereal images of you know, the two leads. I can't believe I'm blanking on names here. Betty and is it Camilla Rhodes? Is it Rita? Is it Diane Selwyn? You know, it's it was more of a stark, oh, it's these two ladies in LA, and here's like kind of a LA noir-esque silhouette of, I don't know if it's supposed to be the Hollywood Hills or just generic LA skyline. It didn't even show downtown. It was just kind of like trees, and you're like, okay, I guess it's gonna be like Black Dahlia, or you know, it's gonna have kind of a Nightcrawler vibe to it. And then I started watching it, and the hard cut to everything Winkies, that was all I needed to just realize this is nothing like what I was expecting. It always goes back to the Luke Skywalker line of this is not going to go the way you think. And I honestly, that's something I seek in movies nowadays. It's hard to find in movies nowadays, frankly, personally. But with this movie in particular, the fact that it does go the way it does with the scene in Winkies, and then again, the surrealism of, I mean, at first it's little creepy things. It's, you know, the old couple that are with Naomi Watts on the plane. At first you think, oh, it's like her grandparents or something. And then you find out it's just strangers. And then they get into the limo and they're doing their like silent laughing thing. And you know, the lady's like patting her husband on the knee, but you hear the knee slapping, but you don't hear them laughing. And you're like, what? And then all the scenes with Ryan Entertainment, which it was only until this viewing I actually noticed it. Really, believe me, people, I never seek out my name in anything. But except to see if somebody's hacked or hacked, created a fake account on Instagram. But like seeing the one guy in the wheelchair who's trying to influence Justin Theroux's character, Adam Kesher, to have Camilla Rhodes in the movie that he's making, and I can finally tell you now who that guy in the wheelchair is. And they did kind of a little bit of trickery to make this guy look the way he did. And I'm going to have to filibuster a little bit because I'm blanking on the actor's name because I still haven't seen Twin Peaks. I'm sorry,
Same.
everybody.
I haven't seen it.
Here we go. Michael J. Anderson, and he's famous for being the man from another place. He's the guy in the red room that, you know, is like, was it, was it, was it, was it, was it, you know, like talking, like speaking backwards. I'll see you in 27 years, you know, and they basically did it so that I think the arms and the legs are from an actual, like from a different actor, and he's sitting there like this and talking into somebody else's arm while speaking to whatever, you know, crony is trying to get Adam Kesher to get Camilla to be in his movie. And scenes like that, and then later on, obviously, with the discovery of the body in the apartment. I kind of look at that as the moment in the film where reality breaks down completely, because then everything after that is almost, you know, it starts feeling like a fantasy. And then when you actually get to the Silencio bar or the Silencio theater, I don't know. I this time viewing it, and I know this alludes to a question I think you had mentioned last night and you were going to save for the episode, about, like, not to steal your thunder, but like finding new things when you watch it. I think that scene where they do go to the Silencio theater, that I don't know. I now look at it where when the two of them start crying, it's not out of like, oh, we know what Rebecca Del Rio is saying, and therefore we're crying over it. I think it's almost like this fantasy they've been living is ending. Because then after that, like, everything just kind of starts falling apart for Naomi Watts's other character, her actual character. Who knows?
The horror element, I think, right off the bat, I think is a huge question mark, because in the beginning, the first 10 minutes of the movie, you get the jump scare. The as I haven't seen Lynch's full filmography, but seems to be his best. And like, I'll let the scene speak for itself if you go watch it, but like the jump scare itself, it's so funny how Lynch can build the tension and you kind of get the sense that something's coming and it's still horrifying. But
By the way, same actress that played the nun
in
as the, well, the person behind Winkies. So it's supposed to be, I think, a man, but they hired the actress that played later became would become famous for the nun, and the backstory with why she has the face she has. I forgot. I know there's more to the backstory, and I apologize, listeners, if I butcher the backstory, but at some point, like, I know she's been interviewed about it, where she was like, oh, I was asked to make a face. I was asked to make some kind of a face, and, you know, I thought David Lynch was kind of cute. Yeah, clip that one, listeners. I dare you. And it was almost like I needed to make a face, like I was, you know, giving him like kind of a love stare or whatever. And so that was what she went with, and that's what you see in the film. So, but I still find it just amazing that like over a decade later, that's the lady from The Nun that plays the nun, you know. And then you go to her Instagram and you start scrolling and it's all scary shit. And then in the middle of all that is Walter Jeffrey, the French bulldog, screaming his head off, and you're like, oh, cool. She's even cooler than how she is in Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, right off the bat, it's like horrifying. But then the two characters in the Winky scene, well, one of the characters doesn't seem to show up the rest of the movie, if I'm not mistaken, and the other shows up at the end. It kind of starts bringing the story back together. But right off the bat, horrifying. And then the whole movie, you're just kind of waiting for that element of the story to come back. It does tie up at the end. I feel like at the end, when things start to feel like they're getting lost, the Winky's characters emerge again and things start to make a little bit more sense. But it's very Lynchian. It's like the ultimate red herring, I suppose, or one of the biggest in the whole movie. Especially because, some of the characters go back to Winky's. There's the bumbling hitman who I think is at Winky's at some point in the middle of the movie. So Winkies is there. You know that this is the same universe, because you kind of have the question, was this like a different universe or something? But it's a red herring that, I guess you can't call it a red herring if it does pay off, but like you're kind of thinking about it the whole movie. I think there's a lot of things like that in the movie that leave you thinking, because the woman from the jump scare, I was also thinking, is this the same woman that plays the neighbor in the apartment building that goes up to the door and says, "Trouble, trouble."
I had thought that too the first time I saw it, and then it kind of became clear that, at least, I mean, to me, it became clear that it wasn't, but it was still random and weird and a little bit creepy in the same way.
Yeah, I think what's creepy about the movie is just how, well, the red herrings, but trying to determine, what makes sense, if it's chronological or not. And that is the ultimate question of, what's the order of this movie. But as far as other horror elements, I feel like it kind of turns into a little bit of a thriller in the middle of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
They're hiding from the mobsters. There is the death that you can't even tell if it's suspicious or not right off the bat. And then there's the threats to the director that are really creepy. You have the director going up to a cowboy ranch, and the cowboy is kind of a creepy character in himself. So,
I gotta find the backstory of the cowboy, but continue, because the backstory of the actor, I don't even think he was an actor. I think he was just like a friend of David Lynch's who was like, here, put on this jacket and this hat and read these lines, and it works, you know, it totally works.
I suppose his acting, I guess to call it one way, is really flat, but like it does work very well. And also, like, Lynch throws in like supernatural aspects in the middle of the movie when the cowboy shows up and like the light at the ranch flickers. So you're like, is this gonna get into supernatural territory? I think the movie dabbles with it. It leaves you thinking, is this gonna go one way or another, which is part of the genius of it. But the cowboy is definitely a creepy character. It's funny how the mobsters in this movie were some of the least threatening characters compared to others. Like, it was not a movie. I do enjoy that he didn't have to rely on the mobsters to be the scary figures of like, oh, they're gonna kill the director, they're gonna cause trouble. The scariest people in this movie never used violence, so I thought that was really smart by him. So it's a movie that every character you see, you're like, where are they going to come back into this? And again, I'm going to repeat this several times, but the fact that all these characters come back at the end in different forms, like even at the end, they're at the party, you see the cowboy in the background. So, in that way, he ties it together, but still leaves you thinking. So, kudos to building that.
A little bit more on the cowboy, because I'm pretty sure I've seen this movie between 5 and 10 times, which I know probably doesn't sound like too much for this to be considered. I do consider this one of my favorite movies. The thing that stood out to me this time, and I'm sure I've heard some YouTuber that speculates, you know, done a 45-minute video essay on the film, which admittedly has helped with some of my own ideas of trying to understand and comprehend, like, okay, I think I get this, I think I get that. Okay, maybe I get this even better now. The cowboy, so I pulled up the David Lynch wiki, which does line up with interviews and discussions I've heard previously about the cowboy, which is the actor who played the cowboy was actually a producer friend of David Lynch. The producer wore his own clothes as the cowboy costume. These clothes were an original collection of costume elements worn by Tom Mix with a value of many thousands of dollars, which again lines up with what I've heard previously. He says to Adam Kesher, Justin Theroux's character, someone out there is probably like, what's the deal with the cowboy? What are you talking about? You've got so many different plots going on with this film, but the one that arguably, I don't know, maybe it's the most personal to Lynch, given his filmography, given his experiences. You know, this is post Twin Peaks. This is post Dune, which, you know, you ask him, he never wants to talk about it. It was a horrible experience. You know, and maybe in some ways this was a response to what happened with him with Dune. I don't know. Hence why he didn't do Return of the Jedi. What the hell's a Wookiee? But I was getting a bad headache. He has said that. He has been like,
So Lynch.
George Lucas was telling me all about it, and I was getting such an awful headache. I'll show that to
He
you.
definitely saved that for some dialogue somewhere later
Oh,
on.
yeah. To have this whole sequence where, you know, Kesher, the Ryan Entertainment folks, and then whoever these guys are that represent the guy in the wheelchair from Twin Peaks, I take it all as his knife in the gut of the Hollywood machine of, you know, oh, you want to make this movie? Well, we want you to have, I'm just making it up. We want you to have Mel Gibson as the star because he's hot right now. And he's like, no, I want Kyle. I want McLaughlin. I want Laura Dern. Fuck you. You know, like I could see him doing that and studio execs telling him, well, we're not going to make this movie if you don't have this person or that person. Or, regardless of the actor, like, we want you to do this. We want you to incorporate. We want you to be less weird and be more conventional. We want more action. We want the Fremen to have these weird audio guns, like in Dune, you know. And even though that's not in the book either. So, you've got that whole sequence where Kesher is resisting against that, and then finally, after he has to briefly go into hiding, which is wild in of itself, especially when he finds his wife getting shtupped by Hannah Montana's dad. And we'll get to that, because that scene still cracks me up. You get to watch him kind of go through this whole nightmare, and then finally he's told to go see the cowboy. So he drives off to this like ranch, which I'm guessing is, I forgot what street he had to go on, beach something.
I didn't see, but I'm
I don't
sure it's the
remember.
LA Street.
Yeah. In the beginning, Betty's like, oh, something or another, Havenhurst. And
Yeah.
I think I remember watching this with Taylor and being like, I was doing my Burgess Meredith from Grumpier Old Men and being like, I have been to Havenhurst.
I went to school at Marshall, which is right on the cusp of the Hollywood Hills, or not Hollywood Hills, but Sunset and all that. So Havenhurst is a street I've been on before.
Yeah. He goes and meets the cowboy, and it's this weird, creepy scene. Visually, it's all stunning between the way the cowboy is dressed, and then even Adam with his, he's got wearing all black, he's got his shades, even though it's nighttime, he's got his weird grunge hair. Reminds me of somebody you and I once knew. Not going any further than that. And then also, he still has pink paint all over him. Which I will get back to, because again, love that scene. It's so funny and weird. The cowboy says to him, if you see me once, you did good. If you see me twice, you did bad. Well, we technically saw him twice. Is he talking to the audience? Is he secretly talking to Betty slash Diane? Or is he just directly speaking with Adam? Or is he, if anything, is he giving you a sense vicariously through Adam that you as the, again, going back to the point of, is he talking to the audience? If you see me twice, something wrong has happened. And with how the movie ends, it definitely makes me think, oh, yeah, that's because Diane must have done something horrible, and we've seen the cowboy twice. Therefore, it isn't going to end great. I don't know. Maybe I've dived too much into the
I didn't even
theory,
think of
but
that because yes, the first time you see the cowboy following that scene, I think is when he says, "Wake up, pretty girl," and it's like a dead woman, or I suppose in this case it's Naomi Watts in the bed that he's telling it to, who's dead. And the second time, he just walks in the background of the director's party. So
Oh, it's so creepy when he does. Oh.
it's done really well, but. And he tells the director if you see me twice, but like at the party, he just kind of sneaks in the back. You think like, well, was he invited to the party or something? Did the director see him earlier? But that's kind of where the where you start to wonder who is he talking to with the director. And I think the fact, and I go back to this, like the fact that it was supernatural when he would talk to the director, and that seems to be one of the more overt supernatural elements of the movie, his presence and the way he drives up to go see him. I feel like there must be some sort of messaging in like that as well, like not only just being a cowboy, but like you got to meet him at night up on the top of a dark hill. It gives me kind of the vibes of, and this is really off base, but Once Upon a Time in Mexico, the ca Mexico, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. How the cowboy ranch is just like this desolate ranch, like in the hills or
Was
in.
it Spawn Ranch? I think
I
that
forget
was
the
the name
name, but
of the ranch. I think it was kind of near Northridge.
it just reminds me of like these spooky, forgotten places in Hollywood where like stuff used to happen but no longer. And it does, and I love the like the comparisons. I do think this is semi-autobiographical, so like Lynch must have had some weird experience, or like maybe he went to one of these old cowboy sets, the old Hollywood, and had a creepy time, or met some guy like this. But I was thinking I'm sure the location plays a part in this as well, but
Maybe the poor bastard went to Santa Clarita and he went to the Hart Mansion and was like, fuck this. And then he left.
Totally. I believe this is something that he drew some inspiration from his own life in terms of like going to a spooky movie set or something. So, the cowboy definitely many meanings, and That's the thing with this movie too. I feel like it does seem pretty obvious to say that, this is the what is it, the love letter or like the message to Hollywood. I think a clear analogy would be to say, well, the director is, as you said, the director is David Lynch, and like, have you been forced to choose a director? But even the little experiences around LA, and now I'm going all over the place, but like, did he see somebody, a creepy homeless person behind a Denny's one time? Like, I really, looking back at the very end, I'm just like, did he get cheated on by his wife? I did see his wiki that he did have a lot of partners, and I wouldn't be surprised if he had relationship drama that he projected in this movie. So I think, the cowboy and the mob forcing him to choose a director really got me thinking that, oh, duh, it's right in front of you that this is Lynch talking about his own experience. I'm not sure if that was your what you gathered on first watch of like, this is Lynch talking about himself.
At first watch, no, just because I really was in for the story. I don't think at that point I had been inundated with a lot of David Lynch stuff. I mean, I had had through, and listeners know this already. I know Sebastian's not a fan of theirs, but we've established this. I do like Red Letter Media. They do talk about David Lynch a lot. They've done Twin Peaks episodes talking about the revived show, and all of that's been fascinating just because the imagery in that alone, combined with everything I've seen in Mulholland Drive, and then obviously, like when you see the I forgot if they were called the Navigators, but the mutated humans in Dune and how bizarre they look, all that surrealism, and to name one more weird example, David Bowie's character in Twin Peaks in the new show, because David Bowie had already died, they just turned his character into a teapot. And it's like, wait, what? Michael J. Anderson, who, again, famous for Twin Peaks, I think he'd either gone into retirement. I've heard stories about him and David Lynch not having a bit of a falling out. So they basically turned him into a tree with like a brain attached to it. Like
Oh boy.
things like that hooked me to this guy, and it made me want to seek out more stuff. And again, this was all more so after seeing Mulholland Drive, because to me, this was like one of the most surreal film experiences I've had in the last several years. And mind you, I think I saw it during COVID, like the first, at least the first year. And I was really getting deep into, David Lynch. I regret to say I'm blanking on a lot of other films and directors that I saw that first year. I know one that stood out just because a lot of his movies, and I think even more now, are on Criterion. Well, yeah, provided by Criterion on Max, Akira Kurosawa. I had two of his other movies in mind in case we weren't able to watch Mulholland Drive that are genuinely creepy, but also movies that he did that influenced things like Star Wars, influenced George Lucas, Martin Scorsese, even. Again, short answer, no. I took it all on face value. Sometimes with a movie that has this much meaning to it, like, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, first time I saw it, I took it at face value. And then it wasn't until I read The Rum Diary, and then finally I went back to reading Fear and Loathing for the first time, then saw the movie again. And the movie made so much more sense. It opened up so many doors, and it's to the point where, listening to episodes of The Falling Middle Cast, where I'm quoting parts of it, it definitely gives that movie a hell of a lot more weight. And it's also why that's another favorite of mine, just because the film offers so much and it's so damn surreal. The flip side to that, and I think in some ways this leads a little bit into some of my thoughts on the person behind Winkies, and this is where it gets into territory where I'm wondering, like, is this too ahead of its time, or is this even ever anything he considered at any point? And it does get a little bit more into socio-political stuff with LA and Hollywood, but the whole seeking fame story with Betty, or Diane, which I'm sure you noticed that was the name of the wait, both of those were the names of the waitress. Yeah. On the flip side to it all, you have the story with Adam Kesher, and we will get to the Billy Ray Cyrus scene, I promise. But then you've also got sort of the main story of these two women, you know, of Rita and Betty trying to figure out who Rita really is, what happened to her, and none of it really ever gets answered. Like, you know, why was she in the limousine? Who was the guy about to shoot her? You know, the why was he about to shoot her, the driver? And I think in a lot of ways it's also Lynch trying to go after it's Lynch trying to go after the whole thing that I know, I'm sure you've seen it. I absolutely know I've seen it, having worked at a studio, is the, you know, scrappy, thirsty young actor or actress that is like star-studded and is ready to, you know, dive right in there and do everything to be the next it guy or gal. And I appreciate it. I appreciate that he's telling that kind of story in this kind of way because, you know, you could easily see or read any or watch any interpretation of that where it's somebody that goes out to Hollywood, tries to make it big, and then it doesn't work out for them, and then they fall into squalor and misery, and you know, it usually ends horribly for them. And in a lot of ways, this is that same story. The difference, obviously, is everything else that happens along the way, and the fact that it does start out so conventional. And you know, the detectives in the beginning, we were talking about it last night, where you got Robert Forster and the other guy, and you're thinking, oh, this is gonna get into that stereotypical LA noir detective drama thing of like, you know, two detectives are trying to find out what happened here. And then it amounts to nothing. It's like a cameo. I mean, he Robert Forster, one of the greatest character actors ever, is in the credits, and that's all you see of him in that whole in the whole movie, as far as I know. And I know as well, because we were talking about it before we recorded, before we started recording, that David Lynch was asked about it when this was all originally supposed to be a TV show. And it's like, okay, is Forster's character, Adam Kesher, are they going to be like regulars in the show? And David Lynch said, and I quote, as I flip through the book, because I'm very fascinated to see, because he does answer that question more or less. I don't know exactly, because I'd only thought about the pilot. The fact that you have that story, it does go in with the whole love letter to Hollywood, but also it is showing you the whole dark side to it, even down to, and I remember this scene, watching the scene with Taylor, and we were both like, man, the scene really hits differently, in so many awkward ways. I still think it's important to the movie, and you also know that, like, at the end of the day, it is a movie about, as masturbatory as it sounds, it is a movie about Hollywood and the film industry. And the irony is that that's something that at one point in time I thought I'm kind of fed up with movies because of all that, because of everything that came out of Me Too and Harvey Weinstein. But Lynch shows it shows kind of that casting couch thing, and he shows it in a way where it's like he's being frank about it, and he's being like, you know, this is something that we've seen, and it's awful, and it's part of the reality of it, and there's nothing that at the you know, it's 2001, so
I think I thought that scene was really I sounds weird to say ahead of its time, but it really took I think it was pretty clear what his message was. This wasn't some sort of throwaway scene, the very intimate audition where I'll just say Naomi Watts, really plays it up, and you could tell that it's like that fine line between being uncomfortable because she never displayed that. She was so perky and cheery before, and then it gets really dark. And then also the fact that the guy she's doing the scene with is older than her father, probably, and he's saying she's like, my dad is upstairs. He's 10 years younger than you. Like, it was so awkward. And so I thought that was really good. It definitely very exploitive, I think. The fact like I thought that was definitely ahead of its time because I can't think of another movie about Hollywood that showed it in that way. I wouldn't say Lynch is some sort of like visionary for showing it, but at least he understood that. I was reading about Naomi Watts talking about the movie, and she said that she didn't allude to any situations like that, but she did say it was a lot of the failed auditions and trying to do things, and like you could imagine the world of Hollywood there. So Kudos to Lynch for showing that. I think that was really important to kind of really ground the story in reality and just be like, no, this isn't just going to be a surreal adventure. Like, it's still dark, so like reining it in like that was good. Yeah, it was funny seeing the cops in the beginning. Like, I don't want to talk about this too much. I also think it's funny how we talk about how it's LA and it's hot, and one of the guys in Winkies is sweating, and it's like, you think you're mentioning this, oh, he's probably scared, or like, no, they're wearing suits in LA. And it's just like, no, it's like LA, like, it's warm weather, yada yada. But the detectives were your typical detectives out of a film noir. They're wearing the pea coats and their attitudes and everything. I thought it was funny how, yes, the movie was in 2001, but even the cars all look older. Like, I thought that was something interesting. You almost couldn't tell what era this took place in, so I feel like there was still some like film noir-y type elements. Like, nobody used a cell phone, if I remember correctly. Maybe Justin Theroux used a car phone, but everyone else was on pay phones. The seedy motels, the old cars, the fashion, which, while it looks like it is 2002, also can be a little bit more ambiguous to different eras.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. But you mentioned earlier, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, about the woman behind the Winkies.
Yeah.
I actually thought, probably one of the stronger horror elements in the movie, but I'm not sure if you've seen Hellraiser.
I haven't, but I know, I think I know kind of the gist of it.
Yeah, in Hellraiser, and pardon the spoiler alert, but I guess this is the plot of the movie. There is a puzzle box.
Okay.
And whoever picks it up, it's sold in like Middle Eastern open markets and things like that, and like your wildest dreams. But of course, there's a price to pay. And I think the blue box and the blue key really reminded me of that. I think, I'm sure Lynch had seen it, but I don't think it was like a very strong like influence whatsoever. But it kind of reminded me of the trope of like the mysterious box that, like, whoever touches it is forever altered. So to me, I feel like that was kind of the other, I hate to say trope, like, this movie, it's hard to say this movie has tropes, but to me, the detectives were reminiscent of film noir, and the blue puzzle box was very reminiscent of like a horror film in that vein of like the mysterious box that gets everybody, or like, I guess, a modern version, like The Ring, where it's just like, the mysterious thing that if you touch it, it's going to be trouble for you.
Yeah.
But so I thought, and that's towards the end of the movie, but I think, we can't get to the end or theories on what actually happened without mentioning some of the comedic scenes, because I don't
Oh, yeah.
remember laughing during other Lynch movies. I mean, I laughed inappropriately at Blue Velvet because it was so awkward when, more spoiler alerts, like, Conn McLaughlin and Isabella Rossellini are getting intimate, and then she's just like, hit me, and he just hits the shit out of her, like, he gives her a concussion, and it's like, this is out of nowhere. For as weird as the movie was, like, it kind of takes you out of it, because that didn't age well. I wonder if his Me Too scene is sort of his mea culpa for saying, like, sorry for treating women bad in my last movies. But yeah, the comedic elements I thought were kind of funny, like, the first one being the Billy Ray Cyrus scene. I don't know if you want to take it away, but
Oh man. Yeah, the first time I saw this, it threw me for such a loop. It's sort of how I look at the it's the opposite of timeless. It's isolating this film to when it came out. 'Cause like to me, you mentioned some of the cars even looked older. To me, when I see this movie, it is so 90s, early 2000s, that weird like what decade are we in? And obviously the 2001 movie was probably being made in 99, 2000, so a lot of transition there. But Lynch is very inspired by and grew up on a lot of like 50s culture and a lot of that kind of stuff. So it's no surprise. I mean, even the start of the movie with the weird purple background and everyone's dancing I think it's the jitterbug, like it's which is alluded to later with Diane. And that scene in particular with kind of the slow jazz music and the kind of blues rhythm. And then Adam's going to his house. He's got his very OG Porsche, his very 90s Porsche that he's driving. He gets home after the whole shit show that was the chat with the Ryan Entertainment guys, where the one guy spits out his espresso and the other guy's like, you know, the very hairy guy from Alien Resurrection. And he's trying to find his wife. And finally, he goes to the bedroom and she's in bed with Billy Ray Cyrus, who I guess is the pool guy, Gene. And it's so of its time because this is the era where he had his mullet, you know, his achy, breaky heart mullet. And I still don't really know the full backstory for why he got that part and why David Lynch was probably like, yeah, you're perfect for this scene. You know, like, it's so strange. And then, if anything else, like, if you're following this from Adam's perspective, after all the other shit he's been through, you do start feeling for the guy. And then this happens. And so, in some ways, like, I'm not saying I'm trying to justify what he does next by getting the paint and pouring it all over his wife's jewelry. You kind of look at it like, yeah, even if you're a director and you've got this amazing home, again, presumably in the Hollywood Hills, it looked like it. It certainly looked like a home from GTA 5.
Yeah.
But, you know, certainly looks like a few homes I have been to in the Hollywood Hills. It is kind of like that. When you are that down on your luck, you finally just say, I've had it, and I'm going to do this. And then, you know, he gets the shit kicked out of him by Billy Ray Cyrus. Yeah. Put that on your tombstone. It's, again, it's so weird and so bizarre. And then it's followed up upon by the one, you know, big mob guy that shows up who easily knocks out both the wife and Gene. And you're like, you're still just wondering why any of this needs to be here, but it does add levity to the film. And another scene too, I'll just quickly mention the whole sequence where, and you keep wondering, like, there's all these storylines that you're wondering, where is it all going to? The guy with the blue eye and brown eye, the blonde haired guy who kills his friend, who for some reason has that one thing of hair sticking out after he shoots him. And then he's trying to, you know, clean the gun, put it down in his hand so it looks like it was a suicide. And then the gun goes off and it hits the woman in the room next door. And she's like, something bit me real bad, you know. And then he kills the janitor, too. And then he, like, starts a fire by shooting the vacuum cleaner. Like, it's all grim and horrible. And I know, depending on the audience you're with, like, you are kind of like, this is so absurd. But then you also have to realize, like, again, there actually is something actually funny to all this. Like, this is so dopey and weird. Because for the most part, the rest of the movie after that is pretty straight-laced, and then it just goes everywhere, and the yucks kind of disappear.
Yeah, I think, to me, those two scenes were kind of like, they did not feel out of place as comedic relief. You know, it was very in the vein of Lynch. It makes you wonder if he explored this weird black comedy even further at some point. But it was fun. You know, I didn't recognize Billy Ray Cyrus, but I thought he was really nice. You almost didn't even hate him because he was also kind of mild-mannered, because he's like, hey, give him a break. He's mad or whatever. Or like, hey, buddy, don't treat your wife like that, because even if your wife cheats on you, you don't beat her up and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, so, and the murder, the hitman also, he also didn't seem too bothered by any of this either. Like, as much as he was screwing everything up, he was just like, oh, man. Like, so, so I thought that was pretty good. I think the other things that I thought, you know, you say it was pretty straight-laced, and I do agree, but, like, I don't know if Lynch has, like, some weird problem filming intimacy, because I mentioned Blue Velvet, where sexual assault, essentially. But there's a scene later, too, where they start having sex, and then the two women, and then Naomi Watts is like, I love you, and it's just, like, I know I was walking into this movie expecting weirdness, but, like, this also feels a little weird as well. Like, I wonder if just, like, if Lynch doesn't know how to direct intimacy, or if he doesn't. And I actually saw some criticisms around the portrayal of, like, lesbians in this. And So to me, that was, like, a puzzling. It was just like a what the heck type of chuckle in the middle of the movie that kind of took me out. Mm-hmm. I think it didn't detract from the movie in the end of everything. But, like, for me, I still think Lynch also kind of elicits those unintentional laughs that I don't know if he's going for it, or if it's just kind of like Lynch is still doesn't know how humans work sometimes.
the first time I saw that scene, the scene where Rita and Betty do have sex, it really is at first like, okay, having Miss, I'm from Canada and, I'm so star-studded and blah blah blah, and she's marveling at, I guess, the interior of LAX, to which I'm like, I want what she's having. But like, because that doesn't happen to me. Every time I've flown back to LAX, it's more like dread, because I'm like, get me out of here. But yeah, like the fact that she is so ho-hum, but also like, oh, you don't need to wear that all over the place. And at first, Rita's referring to the towel she's wearing, and you're like, and even that, you're like, what? And then she does get into bed with her naked while Betty's wearing her robe, and you're just like, okay, where is this leading? And then it does get intimate, and I mean, I know that has been part of the discourse of like, is this, as the movie has the meta exploitation, is this literal exploitation? And is this bordering on some kind of stereotype? And I know it's something that the actors and David Lynch, they've all been interviewed about it. I know there's been some comments made by Laura Herring and Naomi Watts that allude to it being uncomfortable, but at the same time, like, I can't ignore the fact that like these are not only people that have still worked together, but like they have personal friendships with each other. And it's like, I mean, even, I joked about it the other night when there is the masturbation scene, and they talk about it in the one interview where, Lynn, that was for Naomi Watts the most awkward part to film. And she describes David Lynch while he's sitting there, and I don't know, maybe she like felt compelled to say it, but also be respectful. I don't know. I don't think she had a gun pointed at her head. She's very upfront with the fact that like he's just there being like, it's okay, keep going,
They keep
and
crying,
keep crying, if you need to take a break, okay, because there were other like random scenes in the movie where it took a ton of takes, like even the scene towards the end where the line that gets repeated over and over, this is the girl, this is the girl, when she gives the Camilla Rhodes photo to the hitman and she says the line, this is the girl, the scene that precedes it, or the moment that precedes it, of the cleanup tray with all the plates and dishes that break, like the way that was shot, they, I think, literally had somebody up on a ladder just forcefully drop it. I don't know how many dishes they went through when they filmed it, but like it was enough to try, it was basically to elicit a response. And then as the scene is going, there's a line, and I'm blanking on it, but I remember catching it in the film where it's so many quick words in succession. And I remember seeing the behind the scenes where Naomi Watts just kept having problems with just simply flowing, espousing that dialogue and having a talk with David Lynch about it. Questions of exploitation, I don't know. If anything, I still amount it to, if we're going along with the whole you're Miss Innocent Bubbly Blonde from Podunk, Iowa, and you're coming out to Hollywood, it still wraps up with the combination of you're going to be shell-shocked by everything that you see, good and bad, but you're also probably going to have a ton of weird experiences while you're there. And that's not me excusing any of that, but certainly, I mean, even if I just look at my own life, not that I've ever attempted to be an actor or try and live that kind of life, I don't know what you think of all that, but
Yeah, I suppose, the exploitive fact, that discussion, is kind of like, I guess, excused, I guess I'll you say it that way, by, this is how Hollywood tears people down. But, I still think there's a few, like, Lynch decisions that still are like, okay, dude, but you had to choose a busty Latina that's similar to Isabella Rossellini. It's like, I guess you have a type here, and just like, you don't need to show, like, it wasn't super explicit, but like, it's just like,
Porn music later on when she's imagined on the couch topless and Naomi Watts is on top of her.
Yeah, it did feel a bit unnecessary because it also takes you away from like the rest of the movie, because when the director finds his wife and Billy Ray Cyrus, they weren't in the middle of anything. They were just chilling in bed. There was no nudity in that scene. So you kind of that was kind of like an early tone setter of like, we're not gonna like show nudity or anything explicit. So weird choice. I continue to just believe that Lynch doesn't know how to handle intimacy. I'll, leave the door open on that one. But for this being the second example, it's just still weird, especially because he has the Me Too aspect. So like it's just like you're almost lessening your point by exploiting these women. So I'm still iffy on that one. I gotta sleep on that one. But I still think it's didn't break the full immersion, but I think if it kept going on for another minute or two, or if there's even more topless scenes, then it would be a bigger kind of detractor.
We talked about it as well already with the whole Silencio theater, which was very reminiscent of a lot of places in parts of downtown. I mean, I think they go to downtown to go to it. And, I even made the quip to you at one point of, oh, they probably filmed in parking lots we've been to. Which, and to go to another point, not to make it point after point before getting to my main point, this is Mars on Life after all. You mentioned how the discussion we had last night about how, the two guys coming out of Winkies, and when I think about this movie, I certainly, it doesn't make me feel homesick, but it does make me feel nostalgic, because it's like, you can imagine, and you said it yourself that like, David Lynch is from like the Midwest. So the fact that he can spend as much time as he has in Hollywood, in California, and in my opinion, get it. It's amazing. And I think it's certainly something to where you can watch it and, and maybe I'm overhyping it in some ways, because I could make a similar argument with Nightcrawler, especially again, not being in California anymore. But you can feel that cold, that combination of cold air in the morning, in contrast with that really warm, screaming Rick and Morty sun. And you can smell, there's that concrete and petrol and trees and sage and whatever. Like that combination of smells and sights and things that you hear, like it does come back to you when you watch this. And I mean, even that very eerie scene in the beginning where it's kind of foggy, but it also might just be camera trickery, where after the crash, Rita is clip-clopping her way through a neighborhood and she makes her way to Ruth's apartment. You can see that street and, imagine that eeriness, walking by it, walking on those weird pod-shaped things that are always flattened that come from some kind of trees in California that we don't see here, and you're wondering what that is, but anyway, I'm gonna keep walking my dog. Like, there's so much of that that definitely makes this movie so much more tangible, and it elevates it from a, I guess, dimensional standpoint. They go to Silencio after Rita has whatever kind of weird fugue state moment. And for all I know, it could have been David Lynch being like, "Hey, you haven't spoken Spanish in this movie yet. I'm gonna fit this dialogue for you." And again, maybe that too. I think another thing with this movie, something that Los Angeles is very, well, not its officials, but it's something that the city is very known for, it's what makes it what it is. It is very much a metropolitan area. There's a lot of culture there. I'm almost hesitant to go down this road, but like, it's a very white movie. In a lot of ways, it's almost like this Silencio scene is almost like a reminder of, I don't know, some kind of like bygone era, or it's almost like the beast of Hollywood and what it's wrought to the city, what it's wrought to Los Angeles, to the region, has stamped out so much of the things that, people that were already here held dear and loved. And then having the scene where Rebecca Del Rio comes out and sings, and that's her. That they didn't cast somebody. That's her real name. She's a real singer. And I think the song that she sings is like a Spanish version of a Roy Orbison
Yeah, I thought I
song.
was seeing you
Yeah.
crying.
I don't know. I mean, that's the scene where, and I think I might have alluded to this earlier, like that's where the two women, you know, they start crying, and you know, this is after they've tried to figure out who Rita is. They go to Diane Sullivan's place, they find the corpse, and there's that moment. They like Lynch overlaps several shots of the same scene, performed differently, but still the same point. And I kind of look at that as the point where it's like, okay, the dream is about to end, or rather, this was Inception. That was the kick.
Yeah.
And then the realization that the dream is about to end is them crying at the performance at Silencio. And then, of course, it all follows up with the cowboy saying, you know, time to wake up. When you saw the Silencio scene, and then that's followed with the key being found in the purse, and then it's like, okay, we'll put it in the box. The box gets opened. Betty's already disappeared, and Rita disappears. When the Silencio scene happens, I guess, what did you think of that part?
I think, you know, as I watched it, I was trying to decipher any message, not that I was understanding the song exactly, but the blue key, I think at one point she pulls the box out of, like, a new purse.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a purse that you didn't even see before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, that's where things started to get really confusing. Honestly, like, that's where I started to get lost. I thought it was really fun, like, I forget the scene preceding, I guess when they have sex and then they fall asleep and then they wake up and she starts saying Silencio.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that's where it gets like, it's like, oh, it's also, to me, it's almost like where Lynch remembered, like, I'm David Lynch. Cause like the camera work in the parking lot, zooming in on the Silencio doors,
oh, yeah,
the abstractness of the theater performance, the singer falling on stage.
The guy with the eyebrows saying, you know, no, why Banda?
Yeah. So, like, and it's almost seems to be, like, well, it's pretty obvious. He's telling the audience, like, it's all an illusion, you know? So, right there, it seems pretty obvious. But then things get thrown into a loop again when she just finds the random purse with the random blue box. And then, like, the ultimate Lynch scene is then when they go back home and Naomi Watts disappears straight up. Like, she's out of the bathroom or something. It's like, she just disappears. And then, like, I love the scene, the way he did it, where, like, she opens the box and the camera just... Like,
oh, I love when movies do that. I wish more movies still did that.
Yeah, that was awesome. Like that whole like sequence was great. And then like the movie, I suppose, resets.
Mm-hmm.
I love the Inception or like the kick comparison or like the dream is over.
Yeah,
I feel like it's a very, very strong kind of like very kind of I believe that. I didn't think I wasn't sure what to make of it. I assumed the theory of like it's some sort of dream state, but I never thought the kick happened there.
Yeah.
I thought it was at the very, like, and, like, you know, from there, it's like you just kind of have to think about it. But, you know, for me, the idea started coming together at the very end when you see the relationship between Naomi Watts and, oh, God, Camilla? Or at that point, is that her name? Like,
is this after the box falls?
Yeah, the box falls.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see
Diane.
And you see how she's the struggled actress, and Camilla's the successful actress, and mm-hmm. the relationship. Yep, exactly. And then at the very end, she seems to get fed up and tell the bungling hitman, like, please kill her. And he's like, here's the blue key. And then, you know, and then that's where in my mind, I think that's where the car accident happens. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's the hit that happens because he seems to be working for.
Oh, you just blew my mind.
Because okay. He seems to be working for the movie studio because he's looking for Camilla in the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, have you seen this brunette girl? So to me, that's what I thought it was, that it's just like, oh, all along she arranged the hit. And the payment was to go through this blue box of the torment of, like, having a good relationship with her and seeing what could have been.
I don't even think any of those damn 45-minute video essays have put that together. Maybe. I could be completely wrong, and I may be forgetting something, but I think you're right.
And to me, like, again, I can make the Hellraiser comparison just because I don't know, like, a cleaner way to compare it. But to me, the payment was to go through the torment of seeing what your life would have been like. And then the payment coming due with the blue box and the key. And then when it really gets, again, supernatural, the person behind the Winkies with the grandparent figures, mm-hmm. all tiny and creepy. And that was so like 90s horror. Like it reminds me of like the what is it, Children of the Corn, or like all these like movies that were sci-fi on Sci-Fi Channel. Like that was straight out of that, but it was handled really well. And then of course at the very end when she goes crazy and shoots herself, and then there's smoke, which I was reading, you know, the smoke means something, and then like, you know, gets back into ambiguous territory, but to me it looked like, I love your theory of the dream awakening, and I think, it seems to be, my best guess is some melding of that and the the hit. So to me, is it as mysterious as people want to say it is? Well, yes, but I feel like, the hints might be more clear than the internet wants to hype up. I mean, it's still Lynch's creepiest work, his most mysterious work. And, I'm not sure if you saw the bits about how supposedly there was the 10 clues to unlock the mystery on the DVD case or something like that.
I haven't I've heard about it, and it's so strange, just because, I mean, people have asked him, like, can you explain this or explain that, and he's just straight up gone no. And it's like, all
Thanks, dude.
right,
So to me,
well. Whereas Spielberg will be like, yeah, it is about my parents' failing marriage,
God, are we talking about that one he came out recently with Paul Dano, or?
Oh no, this was Close Encounters. like
Oh,
like like
okay.
I think somebody told him, like, oh, is this like anything to do with your childhood? And like it like dawned on him during the interview, like, I think it did, or something like that. I could be
I actually haven't seen that one. That's enough for another one, but
that the
yeah.
Fablemans, I know I haven't
The
seen
Fablemans,
either,
there we go.
so.
Honestly, looks boring, but I'm sure it's good. But to bring it full circle, I thought Mulholland Drive maybe not so mysterious as it makes to be, but I think this is like an amazing example of like red herrings and misdirection and like maintaining the creepiness throughout. I mean, even like for instance, like not even talking about the blue key, to return to the cowboy, the cowboy at the end is just the reminder of just like, yeah, this weird creepy shit that you still don't know how to explain is still going on. So really nicely brought around full circle. Yeah, I'm sure my take on the mystery is, I'd love to hear more takes on it, but otherwise it's a movie that you said you've seen it over 5 times maybe.
I mean, this was probably, I don't know, my seventh or eighth time seeing it, so.
I'd want to buy this. I want to watch it again. I'm sure I'll have a different take on it the second time, but yeah, really good stuff, really creepy. I mean, even down to like the camera work, and like I know we're not a cinematography podcast, but just like how hazy things were,
Oh, the
how
film grain. I miss film grain so much. It drives, like, getting to see it in this. Oh, I mean, take a shot, because, and I know Matt would be like, Ryan's gonna talk about his favorite actor. Ooh.
yeah.
But like, I mean, even Nightcrawler's got a film grain. That movie came out in 2014. And the film grain just adds to it. And I know that with that movie, with this movie, like, it adds to the whole, like, to use a term of Sebastian's, the choogie nature of, like, tourists that come to LA and they wanna vintage-ize everything, where
Yeah.
it's, they want everything to look like a Polaroid, or make everything look like it came from some 80s or 90s camera. There's a reason why so much of that imagery of LA from arguably the 60s, when you had more color cameras, all the way up until the early 2000s, why that all is so timeless, because not only did you have so much radical change going on, politically, socially, in the film industry, you had so much changing. I mean, the fact that you can go from the kinds of movies you got in the 60s to a decade later getting something like Dirty Harry, add another couple more decades and you get this. There's a reason why that graininess holds up, and it's so attached to the California landscape. And, it's just, again, you just don't get that anymore. I mean, even, something like Velvet Buzzsaw, I mean, it was a Netflix movie, so everything's all digital, but even that movie didn't necessarily have it. And even some of its establishing shots of LA, I think, could have used it. That's why the shot, I mean, we joked about it last night, because you'd gotten out of the bathroom and you were like, is that the menu?
Yeah.
But like, the cityscape of LA from the Hollywood Hills, I guess presumably from Mulholland Drive, it is grainy and it is blur. There's that camera lens flare. So the fact that they were able to encapsulate all that and still incorporate that timely vintage look with the film grain, it has to be celebrated. I know that was a long tangent, but
No, yeah, and like even like a 4K, I'm not sure like the actual specs and things like that, but if this is a 4K remake, like or remaster, like
It is this one is remastered. I do know, like I think the remastering was in like 2015.
yeah, like that, you don't lose anything whatsoever. Yeah, it says color.
Oh, 2021 restoration on the 4K UHD disc.
Yeah, like I think that does not take away anything. I mean, of course it enhances it, but yeah, you don't lose any of the intended aesthetic by upgrading the quality of the film. So, the only other thing is that I would love to see this in a movie theater.
Oh yeah.
The one maybe last thing I'll mention is this also like the soundtrack, like classic Lynch soundtrack, but so ominous. And it's like the soundtrack with the scenes of LA, in those scenes you talked about where you see the skyline or like the limo driving in the dark hilly road, like just adds to the sense of foreboding. So it's I can't say it's Lynch's like masterpiece, but at the same time this feels like all the pieces fit. Like it's he's been working on this for a while, and I don't know what year he moved to LA, but this was, I know there's other LA movies he has, but this is it.
And
This
I'll talk about those too. I got a few more points before we wrap up.
yeah.
I'm willing to go the full 90 minutes on this one, since we've committed it. You mentioned the music. I was just thinking, and I hate comparing and contrasting these two movies because it's again, it's like typical of me. There's the foreboding aspect to sort of the theme for the movie that you hear, in the opening credits. You hear it on the DVD menu. The theme of the movie is definitely similar to that of Nightcrawler. The difference is that it's stripped away of that, what I like to call the hipster doofusiness of like, well, it's morning in LA and I'm gonna go out and get a coffee and do my screenplay or whatever, some dumb thing. Some innocent thing that, I've known many people and, many friends of mine who have had success, and I give them all the praise. I believe me, none of what I've said today has been an indictment on anyone that goes to Hollywood or goes to LA thinking, from far, far away thinking, oh, I'm gonna be somebody. Like, no, it's not an indictment on you at all. If anything, it's going after the trope of those that are too hot for their britches and are too overeager and anxious and I've definitely met some of those kinds of folks again having worked at a studio and me the whole time being like Scotty from Star Trek, just the dumb journalist going, this is exciting, but I like this ship. The foreboding nature to it, I think it's amazing how you can have something that really does sound like, okay, this place had to have a soundtrack. What would it be? And I think both movies nail it in such a way just because, I feel like it would be too easy for it to be like, oh, it's going to be some generic, I don't know, for an example, the Mask of Zorro theme, or, it's going to have some kind of Spanish influence, or God forbid, Randy Newman. I love LA. If it's something like that, I mean, there's so much of it that can be easily stereotyped, or, God forbid, worst case scenario, when you wish upon a star. Yeah, there is the sense that oh, it needs to be foreboding because it's a thriller. And it's like, right, but if you're getting further into the messaging of the movie and what the movie has to say about the place it's set in, then I think you need to handle it more responsibly and handle it in a way where if the director or the crew get it, then it means they're doing a good job and hopefully the film is executed properly. I mean, even with Velvet Buzzsaw, like there was a quirkiness to the soundtrack and to the theme, but I call me crazy, but like when I think of art museums, I do think of a lot of strings and kind of classical adjacent music. And well, there you go. That's what that movie has. And I think when you are dealing with a lot of dark material like this or Nightcrawler, you do need to have something that, has that sense of what's going on under the surface, but also have it be so enveloping that you're like, am I going to get consumed by this too? Because you easily could. You know, I as much as I praise these movies, I probably sound like a fanatic talking about them and sound obsessed, but it's also me recognizing that you can be gobbled up by that world, you know, whether it's in media, whether it's Hollywood. And so you need to have music that gives you that sense of fear, you know.
Yeah, I think it would have been really easy to go, and I forget the entire soundtrack of Blue Velvet. I mean, you did have some of the foreboding, I suppose. It's also a mix of synthesizers, the brrr. Like, but
Yeah.
you also in this movie, it's funny because, like, speaking of like, going really back to the whole theme of like, what era is this? The movie they were filming was like a 50s movie or something like that, when
Yeah.
thinking, but like, you didn't have like haunting, echoey 50s ballads in the background. I don't think anyone, I think Justin Theroux listened to like a car radio, but it sounded like kind of like just generic like modern music LA guy, bro would listen to or something. But yeah, there's a few like music, funky music things, but overall I think it did a really good job of like not going this whole stereotype of like, yeah, like just put something 50s and just make it echoey and like, or reverb or whatever, and like it'll be creepy. Like I'm glad it was like better than that. And yeah, I do love the idea of that being like the soundtrack of LA. Like even the Roy Orbison cover, like there, I don't think there was any hint of like 90s-ish music
Not really, no.
or like 2000s. You also like it did a good job too of like not really hinting at any like sort of culture. Like you didn't see, not even passerbys, you never saw passerbys that were indicative of the era. Like you never saw some skateboarders or like hip-hop people or anything like that, you know. It was very buttoned up literally, I suppose. But yeah, music choice did a really good job, I think, all throughout. So no complaints there. I think that's a strength of the movie. I think it's always a strength of a Lynch movie. I also think of, you know, way back when in the Eraserhead, he was just like right from the bat. So it definitely is like a trademark of his. I enjoyed it. I think the movie's definitely stronger for not having introduced dorky stereotypical stuff like that.
Yeah. Now, two other points as well that I'll get into, and one I've been alluding to this whole time, and I feel like we have to address it. So one of the points that I've been sort of getting to, and I think this also goes to the whole conversation about going to Hollywood and trying to make it. And I think it's a theory of mine that does, I think, potentially transcend the movie a little bit, meaning I might be putting in just my own speculation in, and it's nothing David Lynch thought of. But if anything, it certainly adds to the wider conversation about Southern California. The person behind Winkies and their presence, especially by the end, it makes me wonder if there's anything there to be said about, is this at all about homelessness in Southern California? Because in short, I think that you know, obviously there's been talk about, you know, well, why are people homeless in Southern California? What brings them to California? You know, and obviously I've had plenty of arguments with people that are like trying to tell me, oh, it's drugs, oh, it's mental illness, and I've had to be the one being like, eh, no. But given the lack of affordability, I mean, even Ruth's Place, it looks pretty damn nice, you know, and it looks like it's relatively close to everything. I mean, even there's the one point where Betty says, you know, it's going to take me an hour, or rather something to the effect of like needing an hour to like get ready and then go to her audition, to which I'm like, girl, you should be leaving now. An hour in downtown, good luck with that. By the end of it all, you know, you see Diane give all of her money. I don't know how much money it is ultimately, but she's giving a ton of money to the hitman. And he gives her the warning of, like, you know, once you do this, you're not getting any of that back. Nothing, you can't take back what you've done. And then by the end of it all, between her helplessness, the fact that she's haunted by these two old people, which I take that as be careful what you promise others, especially if you're like, Oh, you're gonna see me on the big screen one day, and then
Mm-hmm.
like that person catches you on the street and they're like, oh, you weren't in the latest Marvel movie, you're homeless.
Yeah.
Like there's an element to that that leads me to wonder, is it a warning of like this is where some of that could lead to? Like you could start out thinking you're gonna be the next, this is a weird dated example, you're gonna be the next Taylor Kitsch or Sam Worthington, but in actuality you wind up driving yourself into poverty. And I know it's a serious issue. I know there are people in SoCal that had hoped to make it big and then they don't. And then because of the fact that everything is so damn expensive over there, it leaves them in the worst situation anybody could ever face. Like I don't know. Is it like an indictment on LA and on California? This is like a looming disaster that no one's handling, and so it's going to not only affect people, but it's going to draw more people in because more people are going to become homeless.
Yeah.
Certainly trying to be as delicate as I can about the subject, but I still think it's potentially valid.
Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. I wonder if Lynch has shown any hints of this in any of his other work. I definitely did not see that when I saw it. I hear your point. I'm not sure. I feel like it almost like is not as effective because the potentially homeless person is like spiritual or mystical.
Yeah.
So like that, I feel like that might maybe defeat his point a bit. Like, but then also like it wouldn't be of Lynch to just say like throw a random beggar in there or something like that, you know? Or like nobody in the movie asks for money. You get no other hints. I mean, the botched hit where the hitman murders three people, you could tell it's a little dilapidated, but beyond that, you get no hints of like the homelessness or the dirtiness of LA. I mean, there's a parking lot with like some papers and stuff. Like, you can tell it's a city, but that's interesting. And like, I wonder if Lynch had the foresight to show the kind of the Me Too type stuff. I wonder if like, you know, I don't think he read Mike Davis, but like, I wonder if he saw something or was just like, you know, like, oh, I could definitely believe that, you know, this is something he drew on from experience of like when he went behind the Denny's that one day and to smoke a cigarette, and then there was a homeless, like I could totally see that. So I didn't see that before though. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean it's again it's very much a now idea, and I can say that again from the standpoint of hindsight, but I mean you raise a good point. It could literally have been he was behind a Denny's and oh hey buddy, can I have a cigarette? No. And I'm on record as saying before, homelessness is a policy decision. It's not a social ill. It's not something that, it's allowed to happen by elected officials that could do something about it. It's supposed to be a Halloween episode, and it turned into a very socioeconomic, political episode as well. But, and I think this will be my final point, this is meant to be, I mean, it's not a trilogy. It's kind of a loose trilogy. It's certainly a much more established trilogy than my Gyllenhaal LA trilogy theory. It's not even a theory, it's just a coincidence, really. But with Lynch, I know that conversations have been had previously, and I want to say and some of them were connected to David Foster Wallace, who was a big David Lynch fan. And I know he had written about him, and it was featured in at least one of his books, one of his like art essay collections, that you have Lost Highway, you have this, and then you have Inland Empire. And I've heard that, if he didn't make this, Lost Highway would have been considered his best movie. It would have been considered his best LA movie. Granted, it would have been his only LA movie. And then he made this, and it blew people's minds. And then he did Inland Empire, and everyone was like, okay, it's using a camcorder, and Laura Dern is really scary. What are you doing? Certainly, there's a bunch more of his movies that I'm dying to see. Wild at Heart, I mean, crying out loud, Nick Cage is in it. Sign me up. Lost Highway, I think I said it to you last night. From everything I do know about it, and I know very little, it is very conventional. There is still a creepiness to it, especially with this one guy with white makeup that you always see in memes, and he's got a video camera at one point. It's hard to explain it. You've got that, and then you've got The Abstract with Inland Empire, and I feel like From what little I do know of those two movies, this film blends both of those while still staying on the surreal track. And again, it definitely makes me that much more curious about these other two, but it's also, I worry that it's going to set me up for disappointment because this is such a high bar. You mentioned it earlier, maybe it's not his best movie, maybe it's not his magnum opus. Magnum opus, maybe not, but I'd still say this is probably his best movie, at least of what I have seen so far. I mean, Eraserhead is special. Dune, I still would give his Dune just that much more of an edge over the first half of the newer movie. I say first half because the second half is not coming out this year. Thanks, Zaslav. I don't know. I mean, when you think about those other two movies, like how does Mulholland Drive give you more of a, no pun intended, drive to see those other two, or
Yeah, it shows kind of what he's capable of doing because Eraserhead felt, pretty one track of like Monster Baby, and the other one, Dune, was like, adaptation gone wrong. So I feel like, if you as mysterious and weird as it is, I feel like there's enough to capture somebody's imagination, whether it be the tone, whether it be the weirdness of the story. I think this is my favorite Lynch film out of the few I've seen. It does inspire me to see the rest of his movies. Oh, Blue Velvet, we forget. Blue Velvet's another story. I still don't know what to make of Blue Velvet, but it is more conventional. So I think when people say David Lynch, this is when you look up David Lynch in the dictionary, you should just be like, watch Mulholland Drive. This is it. This is Lynch. So a really enjoyable ride. I think this is my favorite so far, but we have two more California ones to go, or two more weird ones to go.
And whichever way that we wind up talking about those, whether it's Mars on Life or something else, I definitely look forward to those because I'm, especially if we get to see them together, just because I think they will be rather, I don't know, curious adventures into whatever interpretation of LA he may have for them. I mean, obviously with Lost Highway, I genuinely don't know anything about the plot, so I couldn't really even tell you like how is it layered. I know there is kind of like some kind of criminal element story to it, but then again there is that kind of weird borderline supernatural creep factor that leaves me very curious. And then Inland Empire, I think, I mean obviously you think Inland Empire and it's like, well, it's a little off to the side, so it's not Hollywood, it's not downtown, but like what, based on what little I have seen, I mean, if anything, it just reminds me of the rabbit thing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Yeah, any final thoughts?
No, I think I just exceeded my expectations. It was a fun time. Is my mind melted? Yes, but in a good way. So, scary fun for sure.
Right, listeners, well, have a safe and spooky Halloween. Definitely, if you have the time, check out Mulholland Drive. Leading up to or on Halloween, it's up to you. Is the jump scare up there with Exorcist 3? You're damn right. Go check it out. If you can, find a copy at your nearest Barnes and Noble. That's typically where you can find it. And so long.
Mars on Life is a podcast co-hosted by Sebastian Shug, Ryan Mancini, Andrew Martinez, and Matt Fernandez. If you like this episode, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite shows, as Mars on Life is available on Anchor, Radio Public, iHeartRadio, Audible, Spotify, and Podchaser. Find us on Instagram at Mars on Life Show to keep up with the latest news, episodes, and gratuitous updates on the Red Planet. Have a question, comment, or request? Email us at marsonlife@gmail.com, and we'll promptly get back to you. This show's artwork, titled Happy Mars, was drawn by Zachary Erbrick. Our show's regular intro and outro music is Space Explorers by the one and only Kevin MacLeod. Thank you for listening, and always remember, if you keep going, you'll make it to Mars.